Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lopate. As the 2012 election approaches on our home front and the Arab Spring continues to blossom overseas, stories about leaders attempting to wrangle control seem to dominate the headlines. In their new book, The Dictator's Handbook, NYU professors Alastair Smith and Bruce Bueno de Mesquita explain the strategies and policies that leaders use to get into office, and perhaps more importantly, how to remain there. Professors Smith and Bueno de Mesquita use mathematical models, case studies, and historical examples to explain why bad behavior is almost always good politics. The book is published by Public Affairs, and I'm pleased that it has brought you both to the show today. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Pleasure
to be here.
So you open the book by describing the political structure in a town in California called Bell. It's a suburb of California. Why did you decide to start there?
Well, Bell seemed to us to be a perfect microcosm of the logic behind the Dictator's Handbook, which, by the way, I would like to reassure your listeners, has no math in it. Robert Rizzo.
Well, there are graphs. You get to see my you know, seventh grader is doing that in math. So that is math.
But fair enough.
It shouldn't be scary. It's not scary math.
Robert Rizzo, the city manager of Bell for 17 years, managed to get paid $767,000 a year.
Now, this is after starting at like one-tenth of that salary.
Yes, that's right. And one-fifteenth, if I remember. Well, a much smaller sum,
yes.
Mr. Rizzo had a deep insight that led to the salary, which, to put in perspective, the president of the United States, $400,000 a year. The mayor of Los Angeles, just up the road, a couple of hundred thousand. The deep insight was to have a special election on whether Bell would be a general city or a charter city. This is a very boring subject. So, of course, hardly anybody turned out to vote. And one of the keys to successful governance is depend on very, very, very few people. So he set up an election that had about 350 people showing up, that made it a charter city. Behind closed doors, then they could set salaries and tax rates. So Bell had one of the highest tax rates in the state of California and one of the most outrageous salaries for its city manager and its team of supervisors.
So it sounds like boring people may be part of a strategy for a dictator so that they stop paying attention?
Boring is fantastic. The fewer people who pay attention, the better. Absolutely.
One of the things, though, that led to this manager's downfall was that he had a small group of people who supported him in this who he richly rewarded, but they didn't show up for what it was they were supposed to be doing, which sounds like most things were to the letter of the law, but the fact that they didn't show up caused problems.
I think this was the legal prosecution at the end, was that they couldn't actually get them. They hadn't actually broken the law in the sense that they'd legally passed this charter and they'd decided to pay themselves huge amounts of money.
And they wrote their own laws.
It's exactly what you should do. You should get in and you write the laws to reward yourself and your cronies greatly and forget about the people as much as possible. And the problem was afterwards everyone realized, wow, these people have done these heinous crimes, and they hadn't actually, turns out they hadn't really done any heinous crimes, but they'd actually fiddled the books because they paid themselves for meetings that they hadn't attended. So it was a very minor sort of fraudulent, not sure, you know, they didn't punch their clock card when they clocked into the office. They forgot to do that. And that was literally the extent to which they could be prosecuted. But of course, there's this built up hatred by the people when they realize these people have been working for themselves, not for us. But that's what all leaders are doing.
Now, Bell is not a very wealthy city. And one of your chapters is titled Steal from the Poor and Give to the Rich, a sort of reverse Robin Hood, which is very disturbing, like many of the things you write about in your books. But why did you focus on that as a way of keeping power?
So the book is exactly about keeping power. And the way you keep power is you pay off the people who support you, and to do that, you have to get money from somewhere, typically the people who don't support you. So the key to being a dictator is you get support from a very small group of people, for example, the folks who control the guns. You pay them really well. Where do you get that money? Well, if you don't have oil in the ground and you're not getting tons of foreign aid, you have to get it from taxing people. So who are you taxing? The poor, hardworking citizenry, so you can make the rich generals richer generals. And this has the beautiful effect that it keeps you in power pretty much until you die in your sleep. Whereas leaders who rule on behalf of the welfare of the citizenry are beloved, and they typically lose their jobs 2 to 3 times faster than the nasty, brutish dictator.
Now, is keeping one's job the real goal for leaders? Is that really what leaders should be out to try to do?
Well, we don't address the should question. Mm-hmm. It is what they are out to do. I mean, the book is very cynical, and as it turns out, the cynicism is probably also the truth. I had a student a few years ago who was very skeptical that leaders really were that hungry for power. So he did a study of every democratically elected leader in the world since the end of World War II and looked at the conditions under which that person left office when they were not term limited. There were several hundred such leaders. He could only find 4 who looked like they just stepped down because they were tired of power. Yeah, they are that hungry for power. And, for dictators, it's much easier to stay in power, and that's what they're after, and they do it.
So as you approached this idea, what were the first kinds of things that you decided to look at, this idea of how dictators and those of us who think we're in a democracy might lead ourselves?
Well, there's actually a long intellectual history of this. We've been on this project for about 18 years now. And the very early project was simply we wanted to know what happened to leaders who fought wars. If you win a war or you lose a war, what happens? And it turns out people have been thinking about grand strategy and what the rights and wrongs of fighting wars, but they never actually thought what might be the basic fundamental question a leader has to think about when they decide to launch an invasion is, what is this going to cost me my job or not? And so we just started from there, and then everything, we suddenly went, wow, this is a powerful way to approach things, is not think about what the nation should be doing or what's in the U.S. national interest, because the U.S. national interest isn't making a decision. It's being made by President Obama, and he has to get congressional support. It's being made by a relatively small number of people at the top, and so we should be looking at what's motivating them to make their decisions. And then we went from studying war, we started to spend a lot of time thinking about how democracies fight war differently from autocracies. I think we basically have a wonderful explanation for what's been called the democratic peace, why democracies don't fight. And we just find tons of different behavior. And then we move from being traditional international relations scholars to comparative politics, and we found that, wow, the same framework explains corruption, explains public policy, disaster management.
The same framework that governs the way leaders consider whether or not to go to war?
Absolutely. They're trying to make sure that they keep their cronies, the people they're beholden to for staying in power, they have to keep them happy or they're out of a job. And so, for us, it comes down to this cynical approach that we would like to understand what it takes under different circumstances. So we don't think of any leaders as being different. We just think of them as having different constraints.
So when you looked at war and the leaders who have chosen to go to war, what did you find?
Well, one of the things that we found was that Democrats need to try much harder to win the wars that they take their countries into, because when a Democrat loses a war, which, by the way, is rather rare.
And when you say Democrats, as in the Democratic Party or people in democracies?
Well, so we actually don't like words like Democrat and autocrat. What we mean when I say Democrat is a leader who depends on a very large number of supporters to stay in power. People who depend on a very large coalition have to produce effective public policy because you can't bribe millions of people. So what we found was that if they lose a war, then they pretty much are going to be thrown out of office very quickly. So they're very selective about what wars they fight to avoid fighting wars that they will lose. Occasionally they make mistakes. We found that people who rely on very few supporters, autocrats, leaders of military juntas, monarchs, they can afford to lose war. So they don't try as hard to win because for them it's more important to be spending money buying the loyalty of their internal cronies than it is spending money to win the war. They're more likely to be thrown out of office if they don't keep bribing their cronies than if they lose the war. And that was an interesting separation, which raised fundamental questions about pretty much everything that people thought they knew about international affairs.
And as you then took this and applied it to the other kinds of decisions that leaders make, what was the most surprising for you? What did you say, oh, this will never work with this rubric on it?
It's such an amazing thing when we were researching this book that every time we read it, we were just reading stories, because this work had been developed in a very formal academic sense. So we did a lot of mathematical modelling, lots of what people would recognise as economics, did a lot of statistical testing. Then we started just taking the simple evidence that we, you know, these simple ideas to the stories, and the stories is just like everything fitted. We never really had to work. It was a book. This book, as we say, has no maths in, but it's all based upon rigorous analysis. Everything just fitted in. So we had stories. We were sitting in the office the other week, and we were somewhat concerned. Why did Ben Ali get into trouble in Tunisia? And we're sitting there scratching our head for a minute, because it's not somewhere that's not a name brand country that most of us are thinking of most of the time. So we didn't know so much. We're like, so why did he get in trouble? He goes, looking around, we're like, well, he must be broke and he must be sick. You know, 2 minute Google search. He's sick. He's broke. It was just like, you know, having an understanding of what motivates people, it just makes when you start looking at the world through the eyes of cynical leaders trying to better themselves, not the people, it becomes a lot more transparent what's going on.
Now, there were a few surprises, at least for me. I'll mention two. When we started this project, I naively believed that leaders of democratic countries are interested in promoting democracy around the world. They do talk about it a lot. Talk is cheap. It turns out that they don't promote democracy around the world. As a matter of fact, when you look at military interventions by democratic countries, the target of the intervention becomes less democratic on average than it was before. Whereas when you look at interventions by the UN or by autocrats, it has no effect on the kind of government the target had. I was surprised at that, although the logic is very clear that the job of a democratic leader is to satisfy his or her coalition that keeps the person in power. It's not to satisfy the wants of people in some other country. I was also surprised at a discovery that Alistair made that's very depressing. When there is a natural disaster, like a big earthquake, for a Democrat, if you have a couple of hundred people or more killed, they're pretty sure to be out of office quickly. For a person who relies on a small coalition, a dictator, it's good for them to have a lot of people killed. Better they should be killed than assemble in a refugee camp where they could talk to each other and organize against the government and possibly overthrow it. Well, that's a rather depressing discovery, but it's robustly true.
As I was reading your book, I was thinking about a series of books that I'm reading with my teenager called The Hunger Games. I don't know whether you've heard about The Hunger Games, but it's about a dystopia where everyone is kept separate. There is a central power, but it holds most of its power by keeping everybody, as you were just saying, from being able to talk to one another. And it also has the terrible, every year they bring teenagers and have them fight to the death. So there's that awful thing that inspires it. But as I was reading your book, I was thinking, well, thank goodness we don't do that. But the kinds of things that you're talking about the ways to assume power and the ways to hold on to power, are not that different.
Not that different. One of the anecdotes we tell is the election as pope of Damasus I, a 4th century pope, Saint Damasus, who rose to the... He had a competitor for the papacy. He rose to the papacy by... there was an election in Rome. Well, he murdered the 139 people who supported his opponent, and son of a gun! Then his opponent didn't have so much support, and there he was, pope. It was a very important pope. He made Rome the center of the Catholic Church, moved it from Alexandria. But it was exactly the quest for power. It brings out a lot of real nastiness.
I'm speaking to Bruce Bueno de Mesquita and Alistair Smith about The Dictator's Handbook. It's from Public Affairs. Now, as you were writing this, all of this foment in, as you said, in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Libya, has been going on. With what you've learned through this investigation, what do you see there? What are the powers and the forces that are happening there, and how might they fit or not into what you're talking about?
Well, this is a really interesting question. So when do leaders get into trouble? When do autocrats get into trouble? And it was sort of three times when leaders are particularly vulnerable. When they first come to power, because they don't quite know where the money is, they don't quite know who to pay. It makes them very vulnerable. When they get old, this was Ben Ali's problem, a Bayrak's problem. They're old. You can't promise to pay people from beyond the grave. And so they know that, you know, the gravy train that you were delivering, that's coming to an end. They're looking around for the next meal ticket. And leaders who are broke. This was the case of lots of the economies in the Middle East. And I think the ones that have any chance of actually reforming are the ones that the economies are broken. And so you can take those predictors to give you some idea about when leaders are going to have to reform, when they're in one of these phases where transitions likely take place. And then we can think a lot about the direction transitions are going to go. So Tunisia and Egypt, the regimes were in real trouble because their leaders were broke. And the only way they can earn money, because they don't have a lot of natural resources, they have some, but it's a dwindling amount, and the same would be for Syria, is they have to tax the people. But you can't get the people to work. You can't tax them unless they work. They won't work unless you make it productive for them to work, which means you've got to let them talk, which sort of stimulates the ability of them to form, to talk, to organize. And that's what led to people being in trouble. Well, other leaders in the Middle East who don't have the same problems. So, you know, we look at Gaddafi and we think that he made a very serious error. So one of the rules that we set out in our book is never be nice to the people at the expense of those who matter, the coalition. And he made a big mistake. He started educating his people. He gives them much more education than the neighboring states around him. And in recent years, he allowed a relatively free media to establish. These were mistakes for him because he didn't need the people to come together to work for him. All his wealth came out of the ground. And we could see that it got him in a lot of trouble. People could organize against him, and combined with NATO preventing him from cracking heads, it led to his downfall.
I'm speaking with Bruce Bueno de Mesquita and Alistair Smith about their book, The Dictator's Handbook, Why Bad Behavior is Almost Always Good Politics. It's published by Public Affairs, and we'll be back with more after a break. I'm Julie Burstein. This is the Leonard LoPate Show, and I am here with Bruce Bueno de Mesquita and Alistair Smith. They are professors at NYU, and they have written The Dictator's Handbook by Public Affairs. And just before the break, Alistair, we were talking, and you know, you were talking about the mistakes that Gaddafi made. And when I hear you talk about it, I think, what do you mean mistakes? This is what we want to happen. But I guess you're thinking about it from the perspective of, I'm a dictator. I want to hold on to power. I better not mess up.
Absolutely. And that his mistake in terms of holding power was he made a classic error, which was he allowed the restriction. He relaxed his restrictions on media freedom that allowed people to organize. So he went from 2005 having by far the harshest restriction on the media in the region. And we did a little study. We just put together six sort of the Middle Eastern countries of interest. And he'd gone right down to being like joint fourth with Saudi Arabia. Only Egypt had a freer press than him. And he that wasn't a mistake he needed to make. He didn't need the people to work. So in terms of staying in power, he should have never done that. So that was a bad mistake for him. We also think a lot that the West has made a big mistake in pushing to get reform in Libya. We think it's an extremely unlikely country where reform is going to go, because you can feed your supporters very easily without having to rely upon the people. The mistake that Gaddafi...
Because of the oil wealth.
Exactly.
That they have.
And the Gaddafi regime has failed because he made this fundamental mistake. We just don't believe that the next regime that comes to power is going to be democratic, and it's not going to make the same mistake. It's going to be at least as brutal, if not worse.
So it sounds like democracies may work better in places that don't have many resources, because you have to actually pay attention to the people who are doing the work.
Absolutely. When you have a lot of natural resource wealth and don't already have an entrenched democratic system, you don't need to worry about what the people want. And by the way, just to be a little bit cynical again, foreign aid has exactly the same effect as having a lot of oil in the ground, because you don't have to tax the workers of the society in order to generate lots of money. So if, for example, after Assad is thrown out in Syria, if we or some of our friends make the mistake of pumping in tons of foreign aid to try to help establish a democratic government, we'll be helping to establish a dictatorship.
So as you looked at all these questions, did you also look at history too? Did you look at the like we just heard about Cleopatra, at the people who ruled in generations past?
Oh, sure. We looked, for example, at Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar, you know, most people's impressions of Julius Caesar are from William Shakespeare. It's nice that they read Shakespeare, very good play, but he had it all wrong. Julius Caesar's big problem was that he was trying to be too good to the Roman people. He tried to rationalize taxation. He tried to rationalize food prices so they were more market-driven instead of arbitrarily high. He tried to forgave debts of ordinary people, especially in Spain, part of the hinterlands. And, of course, all of that was taking money out of the pockets, so to speak, of the folks
in their tunics,
of the folks who were keeping him in power in the Roman Senate. So they fixed the problem. They murdered him. It's not that he was a dictator. It was that he wasn't enough of a dictator. We looked at tons of examples from history. People make mistakes, they get in big trouble.
So as you look at dictators, and I guess this is a foregone conclusion, if you're trying to write a handbook for dictators, you should not be looking out for what the regular populace really cares about.
Oh, God, no. No. The regular populace, you do have to look out a teeny bit, enough so that they can't rebel. If they're starving, they won't rebel. You need to look out for who are the minimum set of people you have to keep happy. There are really five rules to politics. You need to rely on the fewest number of people possible. You want that group to be drawn from the largest pool of people possible, so every one of the people in your inner circle knows they're easily replaced, and therefore they had better be loyal to you, or they'll be gone and be cut off from the goodies. You want to give the loyal few just enough so that they don't defect to somebody else, no more. You don't want to give more to the people than is absolutely essential to keep them working to produce for you and not rebelling, and you want to tax the people as heavily as you can to pay the costs of doing the other things and for your own discretionary pocket.
Well, I know I've been in the promos to this saying, there's not that much difference between the dictators and the democracies. How do you see that playing out in countries that see themselves as democracies?
Democratic leaders would like to do exactly what autocrats do. They just have their hands tied, that they're stuck with an electoral system and so forth, but they're very clever about working around it. So if we look at the United States, for example, we gerrymander congressional seats. What does that turn out to mean? It means that the members of Congress, or the state legislatures they're associated with, pick who will vote for them. The voters don't pick the Congress member. The Congress member picks their voters. As a result, everybody hates the Congress, but the probability of an incumbent getting reelected is 95%, almost equal to what it was in the Soviet Union for people running for the Duma. Hardly democratic. We are fond of observing that the public debate on the budget at the moment is that President Obama wants to raise taxes on the rich and the Republicans want to cut entitlements. We translate that into President Obama wants to raise taxes on Republican voters and Republicans want to cut benefits for Democratic voters. That is, they each want to benefit their constituency at the expense of the other guys.
It does sound very cynical, as you describe it. Do you believe that it's cynicism that's driving all of this? Or, I know you said earlier, you don't look at what should happen.
Well, the last chapter of the book does look at what should happen. We talk about how one could fix the problems. The rest of the book is about why does the world of politics work the way it does, not just governments, corporations, sports federations, any organization, I dare say, even NPR. We want to understand why things look the way they do so we can figure out how to fix them.
Now, a listener has written in asking if this is similar to what Machiavelli wrote about in The Prince.
Well, Machiavelli, again, was doing nominally what the title of our book. It was a dictator's handbook. He was writing for an Italian family to how would they seize and – or how they would already seize power. How would they maintain power and control in central Italy? And that was the job for him. He didn't do very well. He got fired.
He
actually didn't get hired.
And I will note that two of the reviewers of The Dictator's Handbook have observed that Machiavelli needs to step aside because we've outdone Machiavelli. He was too nice a guy.
Now, one of the things that you look at, in addition to money and resources, is airports. Can you describe a little bit about how looking at how access to an airport is laid out can tell you a little bit about the society?
Sure. This is an observation. So if you go to a third world country, a dictatorial country, you suddenly find it's very easy to get from the center of town to the airport. If you want, well, we're in New York here. We all know what the Van Wyck is like at the best of times. It's virtually impossible to get to your flight on time. Why is this the case? Well, you know, a politician in principle, we could run a nice big five-lane highway right from the middle of Manhattan out to the airport. But the eminent domain we need to do that would annoy so many people, it would dig into the support base. When you need a lot of people to keep you happy, you can't do things that are going to, you know, jeopardize the property rights of the masses. People don't like that.
There were some people like Robert Moses who were able to do that.
And those were the good old days.
and he's no longer he didn't stay in power for, you know, he was removed after a while because
right.
he kept doing this and people didn't like it. So he was pushed. But this doesn't happen in autocracy. So they just drive the road right where they want to. You put the road where you want it. You just bulldoze any houses that get out of the way. So, you know, traffic accidents in China, you know, you clear with a bulldozer. You'd never clear a traffic accident with a bulldozer if we had an accident in Manhattan.
The straightness of highways first struck me the first time I went to Beijing. They were building the highway from Center City to the airport. And I noticed that they literally went through somebody's backyard. While the person's house was still there, they were... The highway was going through the backyard because they didn't have to worry about inconveniencing this poor soul. You can't do that in a democratic country. Even Robert Moses couldn't do that.
One of the things that I took away as I read all of this was that autocracies and the highways made that point for me. There's something about a straight line, and then there's something about the mess that you have to deal with in a democracy. And so at the end, you quote Lenin and you say, What can be done? I can't remember exactly the quote. What is to be done, which is from Lenin.
Yes.
When you look at all of this, you know, you're speaking very gleefully about these things, but I have a feeling deep down you are not looking at this and thinking, how can we get more power for the dictators?
No, not so deep down. Right up at the surface. our interest is in seeing a world in which people have more say over the quality of their lives. And we spend the last chapter on, okay, what can you do to overcome these rules of nature? This is what leaders do. And they're not going to stop doing it because you say to them it's not nice. They're going to stop doing it when it stops serving their interests. So the last chapter of the book is, how do you make it stop serving their interests? How do you get them to look out for you instead of for them?
So how do we do that?
Well, one of the things that we've discussed, brought up earlier, is giving aid to leaders that we want to reform is just not an acceptable strategy. People will undertake difficult, dangerous policies such as holding meaningful elections, allowing the people to assemble, allowing a free press to develop when they're absolutely under the gun, when they really need revenue badly, when they have problems, when they need to buy people's support. That's the only time they're going to do the things that jeopardize their control on power the most. If you give people aid, for example, under those circumstances, it takes the pressure off them. They may have actually been totally sincere in their desire to actually carry out a reform after they got the aid. But once you've taken away the pressure, that sincerity, they're going to find ways to... our people aren't ready for democracy right now, which really means the leader isn't ready for democracy. So we should only be promising help after performance targets have been met, after people have allowed elections, after people allow free press.
You can escrow the money and let them borrow against it and release it only when they meet the actual performance criteria that have been set up, not promise to meet it. If you're a shareholder in a corporation and you're not happy with the way the corporation is run, you can use social networking to create a website presence, a social network presence for the shareholders. So the shareholders can exchange views. They have freedom of assembly this way, and they can organize their own proxy structure instead of letting management set up the proxy structure. And then they can devise means to turn out the votes. The company may wind up being better run. It may not wind up being better run. Democracy is messy, but it will be run the way the shareholders want it.
So as an individual, it sounds like a key piece is paying attention to what's going on that is important to do. I mean, this gets back to the boredom problem that we started out with, that a lot of what is out there may be leading us to go to sleep, and we need to wake up.
So We both find it very frustrating when the appeal to having a better functioning society is that we should be better people. And we don't think that we want just people to be better people. We want people to understand how the system works. And then once they know how the system works, you can't fix something if you don't understand how it works. So this is the primary function of the first part of our book, was to think about not telling people you have to be better people, because that isn't the way to do it. This is how it works.
I've been speaking with Bruce Bueno de Mesquita and Alastair Smith about their book, The Dictator's Handbook, Why Bad Behavior is Almost Always Good Politics. It's published by Public Affairs, and thank you both very much for joining the show today.
Thank you very much
for having us.